Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. You know, yesterday was Super Tuesday for at least the Republicans, maybe for Barack Obama in Oklahoma.
Right.
Other than that, it was Super Tuesday for the Republicans. And it was an interesting election. Some people have been following it, some haven't. But we need to talk about what's going on in this world. This is a very serious election year. We have with us in the studio Marta Hummel-Mossberg. Marta, of course, you read her in the Sun. She's a columnist of Baltimore Sun, the Franklin News Post. She's a senior fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute and a fellow at the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. First time on the air with us, I think. Marta, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're welcome.
Leah Gilmore is with us, of course. She's the Center for Emerging Media's cultural and political correspondent, and she is a community activist, runs nonprofit organizations, is a star across the globe, and graces our studio often, and this is one of those days. Leah, good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you. And star across the globe. I must send a check for you or something. I don't know. That's very interesting.
I'll make sure you spell the name right. So, but welcome. It's good to have you both here.
All right.
So this is there's so much to say about this Republican primary. Mm-hmm. Just beyond the horse race, I wonder, just for both of you, what you think it signifies inside the Republican primary itself, Republican voters, about the battle going on inside of the hearts, minds, and souls of people who are voting in the Republican primary and are watching this for that. What do you
right.
think is happening?
Right.
Marta.
Well, I think it's fascinating to watch how Rick Santorum has surged. I mean, at this point in time, Romney has such an infrastructure. He has so much money. He's been organizing for so long. This is the second time around. You'd think he would have been much more inevitable than he is showing right now. And I think what Rick Santorum has shown is that there's a lot of people who really, you know, he's what he's won are the people who make less than $100,000,
right.
Who don't have a college education.
Right.
He's really grabbing the hearts and minds of those people. And Romney's winning people who are making more money. So he's really not he's not necessarily reaching out or winning the the hearts of people who of all Republicans. And it's just kind of showing you the split within the Republican Party that there's a pretty wide divide there.
There seems to be a real disconnect with the Republican voters with Mitt Romney that I've noticed that they feel his wealth seems to be something that is, you know, a divider, literally. And Rick Santorum, as you have said, has captured those other voters. But what is interesting is, I mean, after a while, you've got to choose. You know, I mean, just for the health of the Republican Party, they've got to choose. I think that if you look how close the races were, it was fascinating for me to watch Ohio and just see, you know, how it went. I mean, Romney won by so few votes. And if you really look at this, you know, this isn't a bad thing for President Obama that this is happening right now. But I had a very interesting commentary early this morning on Fox, which I try not to listen to. Sorry, Marla. You know, it was, but I was clipping and I said, well, I think I'll listen. And then I say, oh no, I got to go. But it was an interesting commentary. It was, he said, well, you know, why don't they stop and think about Mitt Romney for president and Santorum as a vice presidential candidate? You know, and I had not thought like that before, you know, and then you kind of mesh those worlds together. But that's not what's happening. Both of their super PACs are spending, 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 and they're attacking, attacking, attacking each other. And I don't think that can be good for the Republican Party. What do you think, Marta?
Well, you know, not being a registered Republican or not being a party person per se, I don't really think it's all that bad to hash it out in front of the American people and let them see what, you know, what really resonates with them.
That's interesting.
And so maybe within the party, I think everyone's like, oh, you need to leave or Gingrich should get out. And Santorum has been saying that because I need to take the quote unquote conservative vote and move on. But I think people really need to have a debate about ideas and really the whole debate format up until this point has been ludicrous.
It's been ludicrous. You just have
a few seconds to give these sound bites out. Right. You really can't have a discussion. And so I think what Rick Santorum has done, regardless of what you think about him, is really start a discussion about what his issues are. And even if you dislike them, it's just people actually are voting for him because they feel like their views are being represented. I don't think that Mitt Romney, I think he's been – it's really hard to discern what the guy actually believes in still. So to I think it's a good thing to have a longer time to get to know these people rather than decide right away and then sort of like the health care bill. We should have known what was in it before people voted on it. You know, we should know what's inside these people before we vote for them.
I think you're right, actually, especially when in regards to the debate. I'm wondering why we're not having more debates now that there are less people. It seemed to be so many debates when there were so many candidates. Now that we have a fewer candidates, I'm more interested in hearing the debates and what they're saying. I'm very frustrated by some of what Santorum is saying. I would like to hear more of that in context with Romney, in context with Gingrich. You know, I want to hear that together in context with Ron Paul. And that's not what we're hearing right now. We're not getting that opportunity. But I do agree with you about you want to know what's going on.
Yeah, and with someone like Ron Paul, I think that everyone, or at least those who care to know about him, you can find out as much as you want about Ron Paul because he just puts it out there. And, he's speaking directly to people rather than at the debate because he hasn't really been given a lot of time. So I think candidates are finding ways around the whole system to explain themselves to the American public. But the whole setup that we have and the formal structure with a debate system, I don't think has really shed a lot of light on people.
No, I think it's been treated more like a reality program. I mean, even the graphics, the way they come on, it's like, okay, welcome to the reality show of the Republican, national debate. It really is, reflective of where we are in society. I think how we're treating the election right now.
Yeah, you look at this, there's so many different aspects to this. And you started off talking about the vote that Romney and Santorum were splitting. And I was thinking about how there are two things. And one is maybe a little controversial, but I'll throw it anyway. That the non-college-educated white vote in America, which is a huge vote in America, is the one Romney's losing. It's the one Obama lost. I'm going to try this right. 58% to 40% in the last election against McCain, and the Republicans took back the Congress with 63% of that vote, and Romney does very badly in that vote. Even some polls are showing that Obama may pick up votes against Romney in the general election around that issue, but that says to me, I mean, this is is part of what we're seeing is a debate among the majority of white Americans about the future of America. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm saying inside the Republican Party, that's what we're seeing. This is where the debate about where the majority of European descended Americans want to see the country go.
Well,
not in toto, but in large part.
Well, I just finished reading Charles Murray's new book, Coming Apart.
I read it too. We have a discussion on that one.
So I'm listening to you thinking about that book. Yeah. But so when I see Romney and I see Obama, I see the narrow elite, which Murray describes in his book as super well educated, married to the super well educated, very wealthy, live in these neighborhoods, these zip codes that don't intersect with anyone who has an income or an education group that's lower than they do. Santorum isn't like that, and I think there is a huge divide that Murray, I think, legitimately talks about. And his book is the subtitle is The Coming Apart of White America, which I thought was fascinating because he overlays those trends against the entire United States. But there is a huge divergence between how the wealthy and the well-educated think and how everyone else thinks, and those values are very different. And I think the people in those different voting blocks have different desires and needs and wants out of their politicians.
Oh. Once again, we're agreeing. I agree with that. But I think they came from – Mitt Romney is white and wealthy and has always been. And that's something that is totally recognizable by the African-American voters. We see that President Obama didn't start that way. neither did his wife. You know, they didn't start that way. But you become an elite when you go to Harvard. You know, when you get to Harvard, you're the editor for Harvard Law Review. You're definitely dealing with class issues as well as you're dealing with race issues. And to diminish either one, I didn't read the book, so unfortunately.
I have a difficult time with his demographic and statistical analysis and his conclusions, but it's an interesting book.
Wow.
He's also a guy who wrote The Bell Curve.
Well, oh, I totally don't need to. That's right. Well, I can talk about the bell curve, okay? We can definitely have a long conversation about that one, you know. But
which was the last time he was on my show was when he wrote The Bell Curve.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's interesting. Now I'm going to have to pick up the book.
It's and, worth reading.
Yeah,
really
I think so. I think
it's worth arguing with.
That's right. That's why I need to read it,
But go ahead, what you were saying about
But I do. I think there are definitive class issues that are going on, you know, and there's a certain amount of people, both black and white, who feel that they're not being talked to, that they're not being spoken to. But definitely we don't feel the black community does not feel a part of the Republican Party. You know, the Republican Party has not really been reflective of communities of color, which is unfortunate for the Republican Party. Because being a more diverse party would make it a stronger party as well.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure what you mean that the Republican Party hasn't been reflective of black community, overall black community. I feel like that's just
all of it. I think anything that we say, you know, to say all white people making under $100,000 love Santorum is too big of a statement. So that's how you talk. But you have to break it down. You look at the facts. But that the fact is that the Republican Party has not been a comfort zone for African Americans, you know, and it's unfortunate. And the Democratic Party has been and the comfort zone. And that's unfortunate in a way, because then you get taken for granted. Your vote gets taken for granted.
Sure. And I think you can look at a place like Baltimore City and see where you've had a leadership that mm-hmm. has been come from the black community for a long time. And I wouldn't argue that hasn't necessarily served the interests of the people in the city necessarily. So, I mean, to me, it's more of a class issue, much more so than a race issue. And we could probably disagree on that.
No, I think we just said that. No, I just said that. I said class is as important as race, but class is often discounted. It is not put into the argument, because if I am a Harvard Law degree, if I hold a Harvard Law degree, I'm definitely different than from someone who quit school at 12 and, you know, and is working in Wendy's, you know, for no better or for worse. But my access and my thinking towards things are going to be different. That's if I'm black or white. Mm-hmm. But I'm also black, and those issues are definitely there. Still.
Sure.
So it's not really an either or, you know.
And I wonder how much of the – coming back to this thing, I do want to talk – I think that you can't talk about where America is going and the differences going on between these two parties. And there are a lot of people who are disgruntled with both parties.
Exactly.
Tired of both. But in America, the political expression is still through those two parties. You know, I mean, that's where the political expression finds itself. I mean, even if you are a libertarian and don't want to vote there, people have their tendencies, or if you are on the left and would like to really upset with some of the things Obama's doing, the political expression of this election is going to be between those two parties. I mean, that's where we find ourselves in America today.
Right.
That could explode and be different in the next 4 or 5 years, but right now that's where we are, right?
Right.
Who knows? I mean, we'll see.
Well, unless we turn over to proportional representation, which I doubt will happen at a large scale, you know, or at least at the national level. But I mean, that's our two-party system, so we're never going to have a European system where we have, small representation.
I wish we would, but we don't.
So then
the issue comes down to me is that as represented by these two gigantic forces, Republicans and Democrats. Then you watch what's happening in the Republican primary. I wonder how much of it is for both of you built around race, built around different perspectives on race, whether it's Santorum's attacks on single women and welfare, which he does all the time. There's always these code words, what that really means, you know, and how much that is just a part of a fear that America is changing. You know, America has been seen for over 200 years through a very white lens. That lens, since the late 50s through now, has changed for lots of reasons.
And it's not going back.
And so that I wonder how much of that fear and that is part of the battle going on that people are afraid to talk about and don't want to talk about.
Well, I mean, race is always a part of the discussion. But, I mean, I think going back to the Murray book, just briefly, I think he chose to talk about becoming a part of white America to show that this isn't just a race issue. This is the whole country's issue. And that so when Gingrich makes comments, for example, that, you know, inner city kids should go get jobs as janitors within their schools or things like that, that it's an immediate connotation that he's speaking about black people. I think it was very savvy of Murray to go and say this isn't an issue, you know, of just black people or just Latinos, or this is an American issue that we need to deal with, and this is illegitimacy is a problem throughout the United States, no matter what race, what class you're talking about. There's actually a great book by this guy Theodore Dalrymple, who is a British physician, and he wrote a book called Life at the Bottom, which is about the British underclass. And I read it right before I read the Murray book, and what was fascinating to me is that he's talking about the whole white underclass in Britain. And that is just it's the mindset that keeps you and perpetuates the situation. And it's not, you know, it's over there. It has nothing to do with being black. It has everything to do with making poor choices. And I think that's something that needs to have more of a discussion over here, because we're so knee-jerk in assuming that that's what people
well,
are saying.
Well, there are some definitive race issues. I was just in the UK and on a panel discussing race issues, and there are some definitive difficulties in the black community and the white communities, and those also dealing with poverty. I mean, Martin Luther King had the Poor People's Campaign, which wasn't about race, which was about getting all poor people together and saying, look, we're stronger together. But race always infiltrates. I think it's a disservice, you know, to say that, you know, when I hear someone talk about welfare mothers, if I hear someone talk about single mothers and they need to change, we perceptually automatically go to, you must be talking about black people. Or if I hear, we want to take our country back. Let's take our country back. You know, when that means, who are you taking the country back from? This black president? You must want the country to come back to what it was before. Now, that is perceptually what we hear based on all of our experiences here in this country. It may not be what you're saying,
but that's
the reaction. That's what you perceptually hear. And I think for us not to address it is the disservice that makes it keep perpetuating itself. What I'm concerned about is more about what the Republicans are saying about women's issues. You know, and I would love to hear, you know, your perception about what Rush Limbaugh just said, who, as a radio person, you know, and what he just called us a very young reproductive justice activist.
A slut.
A slut and a prostitute for using birth control.
I thought it was totally inappropriate, mm-hmm. and I thought it was good for him to apologize.
With caveats. With so many caveats. He always has those, you know.
But I will say that I don't have a problem with his argument about the whole access to birth control being mm-hmm. a right, because basically, you know, it's one thing to have access to birth control. It's another thing to have the government pay for it and force other people to buy it for you. So that discussion, I think, is a very legitimate one that we should have been having. And his comments, I think, overshadowed the bigger issue mm-hmm. there, because he went off and just –
That's
know,
way bigger than that discussion, right?
Yes. And, right. And that, I think, should have been – you know that's the discussion we should be having, but instead we're focusing on Rush Limbaugh. And
that's what happens. Though I mean, there's sometimes with the extremist, you know, in media get the coverage, and the real discussions never really get heard. You know, the discussion about birth control, you know, who has the right to control your body, you know, our bodies, you know, who can tell me what to do with my body. That's a real discussion if you disagree with me or you agree with me, but not the wing nuts, excuse me. But of the party, of either parties, mm-hmm. should have the ownership of what's happening. And I think we have to hold the media accountable to that as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's, I think people just, you know, you latch on to that because you can get a soundbite out of that,
right.
And that, you know, 24-hour news culture, that's who we are right now. And it makes it difficult to have, you know, to have a discussion like we're talking about. So,
well, I mean, what you just raised here, I mean, that is part, again, of the core political issue. I think that is going to be part of the general election, and I think could maybe, and throw this out if you agree or disagree, that it might, could hurt the Republican candidate, because I think it appears that the vast majority of Americans think that contraception and reproductive rights are part of health care, and they should be part of health care and part of a woman's right to make those decisions. And they should be part of whatever the health care package you have, contraception should be part of it. And that's good. And I think that if there's one thing that could kind of tear apart a Santorum inside or the others, it could be that issue, because I think that issue is
one of the
dividing
lines.
Just
look at the numbers. Even, what is it, 95% of Catholics use contraception? You know, this is very much a reality that, especially among educated women, that you're not going to get that vote if you say you don't have a right to contraception of birth control in some way.
But see, that's not the question here, though. Mm-hmm. The question is, do I deserve free contraception? I mean, when you look at health care, I have to pay for all sorts of things that are medically necessary, you know, including tests. You know, I'm pregnant now, so I have to go through these things. And it's just, you know, it's not and I would consider that a lot of what I have to do preventative care, whereas contraception, it's a choice to have sex. So it's
a choice to have a baby, though.
Yeah,
it's a choice to have a baby, too.
I think contraception is also preventative.
But I don't expect to get it for free. I think that's a totally, you know, having access to it and getting it for free.
I think
free
that's because you can pay for it. See, the difference is there are a lot of women who cannot afford it, but we can prevent HIV AIDS. We can prevent, you know, STDs. We can prevent unwanted pregnancies if we have access to free contraception. You know,
but, you know, what's interesting to me is to have this conversation now, you know, what is it, 50 years after birth control really started?
50 years, right?
And you look at the illegitimacy rate and how it's just skyrocketed. And that's not, you know, you ask people why they're pregnant, study, you know, survey after survey. Mm-hmm. It's not because they couldn't get or they didn't have access to very low cost birth control. It's just that they chose not to do it. And so I feel like this argument is flawed in the sense that, you know, they say it's so much cheaper. The government says it's so much cheaper if we can just provide this and it cuts down on births and abortions and everything else. But it hasn't.
But the STD rates have gone down in certain communities because of it.
Because of free condoms.
Condoms are also birth control, and access to free condoms have been a blessing for many, you know.
But that wasn't that hasn't been the argument in this particular discussion. It's been about oral contraceptives, not about condoms. And they are much cheaper than oral contraceptives.
You know
what,
I think it's really interesting, though, that we don't have this argument about things like Viagra. And the, you know, and other things like this.
Oh, I completely agree.
It's ridiculous to me that a health, you know, insurance will cover Viagra, but I have to pay for my birth control. You know, that's absolutely ridiculous. I think there's so many things that just don't make sense. And one of those things is that access to birth control should be for all, to me. And the fact that Viagra is paid for by insurance companies.
Well, I don't know if it's free.
I'm sure there's a copay.
Yes.
I'm sure we all have copays. Right, right.
I mean, and I think there are, I mean, I do think that this is one of the issues that will cover a few more that are going to, I think, take part in this Republican primary Democrats. But this particular issue we're talking about now when it comes to contraception, I mean, isn't it true that even though we say people have access, they don't, because it's the same way that people in poverty don't have access to decent food, they also don't have access to health care or clinics or place they can go or even afford a diaphragm or afford whatever people want to use. I mean, I think that there was a study I was reading about the other night that one of the reasons that even though there's higher sexual activity among people who are not married in Scandinavian countries, there's a lower abortion rate because they have access to all the contraception they need so people don't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
the Netherlands, Belgium. nor, you know,
I just
across
think
the board.
It's hard to argue, though, that people don't have access to condoms. I mean, they're like you had mentioned, Leah, that they're given out for free all over the place. They're also very cheap, and you can buy them in everywhere you go, you know, regardless of where you live and whether or not you're poor. So I just think that it's not so much that people don't, you know, don't have access to them. It's that they're choosing not to make the decision to use it. And that's I don't know how you force people to use them.
But, you know, I don't think that's up – if people aren't choosing, that's not only poor people who aren't choosing.
Oh, it's – yeah,
you know, then it would be across the board, you know. I mean, but the unfortunate thing is that even something as – that we take for granted as transportation to get to the place to get it, we some of us cannot even conceptualize that that's an issue. But that's an issue, especially in Baltimore. If you live in Baltimore County – trying to get to some place to get out access to good health care is difficult because I may have to come downtown Baltimore in order to get to the place that's giving me the free clinic or something. Oh, that's just too much work. How am I going to get child care? I've got classes in the morning. I'm trying to go to school. I'm trying to raise kids. That world is a little bit different than the one that we know. And for me, I know a little bit about it because I was a young mother. But I was married, but still a young mother. And the access, you know it's there, you know how to get it, but when you can't get to it, you say, like most young people, oh, that's just too hard, you know? Maybe I should try a little bit more. But we can't take away, I think it would be egregious to take away, subsidize birth control for young women and, you know, period. You know, I don't think this is an either or. I don't think it's questionable. And I think like it's just the 50 years we're having this argument and the argument has become so politicized. I mean, mostly I don't think folks it happens at every political cycle.
Well, no. And even Rick Santorum, though, for all everything he said, as he said himself, he's voted to give money to Planned Parenthood. So that's politics. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you're going to, you know, people are so worried about him taking office. And, you know, I feel like politics will not allow him to do what he is saying he wants to do right now, because it's just impossible.
But politics would not allow him to give even in office if he keeps saying what he wants to do.
Sure. So I think the hype about this is overblown. I mean, the one thing I would like to mention, though, is the whole debate over the Catholic Church being required to...
We can get to that in a moment.
Okay.
We'll take a quick break and come right back with Marta Mossberg and Leah Gilmore as we look at the Republican primary, what it says politically about us and America. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are talking about Super Tuesday, which happened yesterday, and beyond, and what the heart of this election really means, what it's saying about America and the battle America is having with itself about who we are. We are joined here in studio. Leah Gilmore is with us once again. You know, she joins us at least every month, sometimes more. This month has been more, which is good. She's the Center for Emerging Media's cultural and political correspondent. She's program director with Moving Maryland Forward Network. Marta Hummel-Mossberg is senior fellow at the Maryland Policy Institute and a fellow at the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. Columnist for both the Baltimore Sun and the Frederick News Post, and is a substitute host on another radio station.
Yes. Right. won't mention.
Right. I think we're allowed to.
The other one.
I don't know if we're supposed to or not, but it's a commercial station that has more conservative talk.
Right.
How's that?
That's great.
I already know what it is.
And it's not WCBM. Okay. So it's WBAL, I must say. It's no big deal.
Right.
So,
yeah, she's great.
Just teasing. So you wanted to bring a subject up here, then we'll move on to something else from the left.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to mention briefly the whole debate over the Catholic Church and the contraceptive issue, because I think that's a different one than the one we've been having, because, you know, that I think is an issue where the church should be exempted from the requirement that they provided, because it really – it goes directly against their belief system. And I have a hard – I mean, I have a hard time feeling overly sympathetic with the Catholic Church in the sense that they jumped into supporting Obamacare right away. And so now they're kind of saying, no, we don't like this aspect of it. If you're going to embrace it – embrace it. If not, you know, these are the consequences for doing that. But at the same time, I think this is a serious freedom of religion issue, and I expect to see this in the courts in the coming year. So,
well, I expect to see it in the courts as well. But I also say, if you're going to embrace, you know, the healthcare plan that was put forth, you should have read the fine lines, because it has always been a part of it, and as it should be, I think. But I definitely do see that going to the courts as well.
So, when again, looking at what Tuesday said to us about where this election is going to go.
It's going to keep going.
It's going to keep going. Obviously, right. This could go down to the – for the Republicans, this mm-hmm. could go down to the convention itself. People could be battling all the way to there. Maybe not, but it could be. And it really shows this kind of, divide – inside the Republican Party, and there's one inside the Democratic Party as well, but this mm-hmm. is showing the divide inside the Republican Party. And I wonder how we view where this takes this campaign, and especially vis-a-vis, let's step back for a minute, the super PACs and the role of the super PACs in this election mm-hmm. And the role they'll play in the general election.
Right.
I want to start a super PAC like Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Why not?
I know.
Everybody else is. I could just hey, – Mark, we could get together.
Start a
super PAC. Yeah, I think it's scary, to be honest, you know. But it's democracy at work in some type of way, you know. But I think it's scary.
You know, all the money in politics mm-hmm. Really doesn't bother me. What bothers me is the lack of transparency about who is giving and how much. And if there was a, you know, immediate disclosure about who was paying for things, I think people would be fine with that. I mean, you look at all the donations to any candidate, or at least the governor and mayor in Baltimore, the governor in Maryland. You can't find out who is giving, because there are all these LLCs and you don't know who's behind those. And it's just it makes the whole process. I mean, I think it makes a lot of people very cynical about the process.
Right. So
I think we spend this was a last election cycle. I think that someone analyzed it and found out that we spend less on campaigns than we do on yogurt annually, you know. And I feel like the amount of money we spend in politics is very important. This is about the future of our country and where we're going. So I don't have a problem with the money. It's about, okay, where is it coming from?
Well, that's the thing I found that's what I think is scary, the lack of transparency. You know, where is this money coming from? You know, there are definitive rules that you do have to disclose, but super PACs don't have the same rules. And that's the scary thing, you know, nor do they
scary
have this.
Scary in what sense for you?
Well, because there's no transparency, you know, somebody can give $2 million, you know, and I don't have to know who it is, you know, and I would like to know who it is. As an American, I would like to know who it is and who is driving it. Because you know what? A lot of times it's who has the most money wins in elections. Because we can keep going. We can keep going and we can keep going and we can keep going. And when there's lack of transparency, then the American people are losing. I don't care if it's Republicans or Democrats, period.
Well, do either one of you see a problem in what the power of unrestricted funds and money does to a democratic process? I mean, you can have $2 million, which people have done, in North Carolina recently in different elections mm-hmm. where you flood a very simple, small series of legislative elections so that people who have been there a long time get smeared and destroyed, mm-hmm. have no way to fight back because they can't go against some multi-billionaire who wants to fund elections to change the nature of who makes up the House or Senate in North Carolina. It can happen on larger levels. Is that a problem or not a problem?
Well, you know,
maybe I was a little pejorative than the way I asked it, but go ahead.
Well, right. I don't. You know, I think in many ways, people who are challenging incumbents need twice as much money as the incumbent, because they are privileged to getting free media attention. They have, much bigger donor base. The media issue is the bigger one, though, and you have to buy so much when you are challenging someone who's been in office for 6, 12, you know, some 18 years. So I think it's important that the people who want to get their ideas out there have the ability to do so. And if a challenger had to spend just exactly the same amount as an incumbent who had been there for over 20 years, how is that fair? I find that completely unfair. So I think money can be very helpful in kind of changing the guard. And first of all, there's very little turnover in Congress. I mean, the reelection rate is still.
But once you're an incumbent, you're pretty much there.
Yeah, for life. Yeah,
so is that an argument for public funding instead of corporate funding?
No. Not in my mind.
Why not?
Because public funding, there's a set amount of it.
Right.
And so you're basically saying that each candidate would have the same amount. And I don't think it requires the same amount of money for a challenger to overtake an incumbent as it does for an incumbent to win an election against a challenger. So I find that very unfair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on the fence about it. You know, I really see the and I'm not on the fence about much, okay, as you know, but I really see the positiveness of public funding where there's equability. But the reality is it's not equal. You know, the incumbency is monetary in some type of way, just the incumbency, just that.
Oh,
you
it
know?
Has, no, it has, it's and worth the, a huge amount of money.
It is worth a lot of money. And I don't think Democrats or Republicans should be, put in a position where they can't fight or they can't, you know, fight for change. And the unfortunate reality is that takes money, and that takes more money than public funding often.
Well, no, Barack Obama didn't, you know, he went above and beyond public funding because he and.
Well, he paradigm changed with fundraising. I mean, there was a bit of brilliance there, and I think the Republicans caught up. I don't think we're going to have that type of, you know, he took $5, $10, $25 donations and turned it into millions and millions and millions and millions. It's really grassroots. And that was something the Republican Party hadn't done yet. So I think we're at an equal level now. They've caught up by now, you know, definitely, you know.
Recently, Benjamin Netanyahu being here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the issue of Iran and how it's being played inside the Republican Party by the Republican primary, it felt to me listening to the Republican candidates of whether or not I actually don't have an agreement in many ways with either President Barack Obama or the Republicans on this issue of Iran. Mm-hmm. Having said that notwithstanding, it seems like there was a certain level of demagoguery going on.
Yes.
Inside of this Republican primary around that issue?
I think so. Oh, good.
No, well, just being, you know, Republicans want to seem like they're hawkish and that America, you know, the America is strong model. We should get involved with these things. That goes on. I think a lot of people, though, are really, really tired of being at war. And it doesn't matter what party you're from. And you've looked around and you've seen that, you've had neighbors or relatives who have died or been injured. I think it's really hard to pass those Wounded Warrior commercials on television without bawling your eyes out.
I think it's irresponsible. I mean, Iris, I think the demagoguery is irresponsible. We know we're a strong country. We know it. We don't need the demagoguery. And I think you're exactly right. A lot of us are just tired. And even in this country, we are more filtered from the realities of war. You know, we don't see the coffins being brought back. You know, we don't see, you know, what a lot of the other countries see that have been happening in the wars that we're involved in. It's almost like we're having stealth wars, but we're still tired of it. So I think it frustrates me when I hear that type of hawkishness used politically. Because when you're using war politically, you are talking about human beings who are dying. So I don't think we need to do that.
Well, it's also worse. Everyone knows we're broke. So I don't know that getting involved with another war is top on a lot of people's minds. We can't.
A war is how we got unbroke once. Well, you know, but I don't think the same situation applies, you know.
6 years ago, I got, as you say, unbroke.
I just made up that word. You know, it's my intelligence is just bizarrely amazing, you know.
It did break the country. I mean, it opened the country up to growth in the 40s. It's destroyed us in this century.
Well, I don't think war ever creates growth. It's like, do you invite a hurricane so that you can rebuild everything afterwards? I mean, it's just, you don't know what would have happened.
World War II, we wouldn't have full employment. We wouldn't, What got us out of the depression was the massive government spending that ended up being spending for the military in World War II. That's what got us out.
And that's just a
exploded
fact.
Exploded our economy for the next 50 years.
Well, I don't think we know what would have happened. Obviously, we can't go back and relive that that scenario. But, I mean, I don't think that you invite destruction so that you can then employ people to build after, to clean up the mess. So
I completely agree with that. I completely agree with that. And I hope that the Republican Party also completely agrees with that. But that is a fact about after World War II, what happened, the rebuilding. But you should never invite destruction, because we're not just talking about buildings. We're talking about human beings. You know, we're talking about families being upended. We're talking about real destruction. And just to rebuild an economy, there's another way to do it.
And that seems to me when Romney and the others were talking about, after the Super Bowl and the Clint Eastwood commercial about Detroit came out, and then the whole battle over Detroit and investing in Detroit or not investing in Detroit, which I think hurt Romney in Michigan a lot, even among Republican white working class voters who came out of the industry. I mean, that to me, again, is at the core of the discussion about which way America should go, and it's being fought out in the Republican primary. And it'll be an issue in this general election, which has to do with what fuels recovery in America.
I don't think they're really sure. I mean, I think definitely there was a victory in Michigan, and they're going to take political advantage of it. But we were in some serious, and we still are, in some seriously deep economic distress. And that's just a fact. And I think that we have been looking for different ways to get out of it, And we have seen some growth. We have seen some growth, and then we'll fall. We'll see some growth. We see some growth, and then we'll fall. I don't think anyone has a definitive answer right now. But I think you cannot be against, recovering the auto industry politically. That's just a political fact.
Yes and no. I mean, you can't when you're running for president in Michigan.
Right, exactly.
But, when the government picks winners and losers all the time. And unfortunately, in my opinion, because I think that who knows if the government hadn't bailed out the auto industry. I mean, we know a lot of people would have lost their jobs. But, why not choose, 15 or 20 other businesses that would have equaled that amount of workers? I mean, why, you pick those because it's a big chunk of people and it was a big union vote. And I think it was very important to show that, to shore up Obama's constituency. I mean, but if you look at the stimulus, I mean, the job numbers are all over the place. I mean, there's no way you can actually measure what was the jobs created out of the stimulus because it's, saved or created. It's been proven that many of the jobs that were created were held by people who already held jobs and just switched around. So we know that the stimulus didn't work as it was intended. And so the question now is, do we step in and do more of the same old thing that hasn't been working well?
Right. And the stimulus was a Republican idea. I mean, when this started before Obama was elected. So, I mean, he just went on and did the same thing.
And made it much bigger.
And made it bigger and wanted it, he did make it bigger, and I don't know if that was a great move. I always thought that, where's the stimulus for the middle class? Where's the stimulus? We're helping the big businesses. I mean, I understand economics, but where are the people? The middle class has almost deteriorated from our country. And that is how we start to really feel the financial suffering.
And do we think that this is going to be part of what's going to be in this debate, in this election? I mean, one of the things that this Republican primary has shown that I was looking at some stories here this morning, that when you look at the Santorum surge – that happened in this – is happening in this Republican primary, that the polls have shown that what fuels his voters are issues of conservatism and moral character.
Right.
They're social issues that are fueling this, not political issues. It's not this great gap between Romney and Santorum and Gingrich around – because they're not even talking about political economic issues at all. They're talking about everything but that. And so this is what's fueling this this explosion inside the Republican primary right
well,
now.
Well, Santorum is winning the states where these social issues are traditionally very important. I mean, the southern states, I mean, he's Tennessee, you know, where the traditional Republican social issues.
Well, evangelical Christians voted, you know, there's a heavy proportion of them in Oklahoma and Tennessee.
Where of course, that's where he wins. Mm-hmm. And when people talk about when you ask folks, and I just read this morning, when you ask folks, well, who do you think will be best for the economy? They'll say Romney. They'll say it, you know. But maybe the folks who are most activated are the ones who are most socially interested. You know, mm-hmm. at this point, even though our pocketbooks are a heck of a lot less, I would be more concerned about, you know, who's going to fix the economy. I'm personally sticking to where we are now. You know, I think we need the continuity. I don't think you can fix an economy that was just decimated in 8 years. I don't think you can fix in three. You know, so I think there is some continuity that's needed. But I'm tired of hearing about the social issues. Really, I don't think I want the president of the social issues. I want a president who is going to lead me, not based on those issues. Those are personal. Those are personal. You know, separation of church and state, my religion, my faith, my choices, what I want to do are personal. I don't want to base a president on who I want to have a beer with. I like a smart president. I like intellect. I mean, I was uncomfortable with Santorum saying something about when Obama said everyone should have a right to go to college. And it was kind of taken out of context. And he say, you know, he's an elitist or something like that. Now, that makes me uncomfortable. I think we're all talking about the wrong thing. We need to be talking about what making this country stronger, period. Those aren't the things we're talking about.
Well, I mean, long term, I don't necessarily know if it's elitist to say everyone should be going to college, but the fact is, this kind of, most people don't go to college, and we should be finding a productive work for most people in this country, and for some people that means college,
right.
For
and
other people
what,
that means vocational.
And President Obama
and,
actually did say we should be giving more to community college and vocational schools, but like all things, those are the things that get chopped off. And surely some of what Santorum said got chopped off, to put it in another perspective. Obama supports community colleges vehemently and technical education because not everyone can afford or will be ever going to college. You
no,
know?
I mean,
but it's not elitist to go.
Oh, no. I think what people are trying to, you know, people who are voting for Santorum, they have an idea of what the American dream is, just like, you know, and it's an aspirational dream of, you know, God and country. And that's what they're holding dear. And I think that with Romney, you know, his whole campaign is believe in America again. He's trying to tap into that as well. And so I think people want to know that there still is an American dream. And that's, I think a lot of people are really worried that that isn't the case anymore and that their kids are still living with them and they're wondering why that's the case. They're wondering why they can't make a living and why they can't make a car payment, why they have such huge student loans. I mean, there's just so many things that just don't fit with, you know, what we know of America. And that is very troubling to a lot of people.
I mean, one of the things that in an article, interesting article recently about that, which we were just talking about, again, we'll see how this might play out in the campaigns to come, is that there is no investment in public. The investments, the money being spent on public colleges is diminishing, mm-hmm. whether federally or in terms of the state. And so we have this huge job gap, but there's no longer a place where people can go to be trained
exactly.
for the jobs that you need.
Exactly.
We're crying for nurses. Well, nurse curriculums are being cut. You need machinists, which takes computer training. That's being that money's being taken out of colleges.
But you can't afford to go.
So I mean, that's where I think some of this discussion may or may not come up, but that is clearly.
But I think Marta was right about one thing. People are wondering. These are issues. There is even across race lines, some class lines don't have to worry about the American dream because they have it and they've had it for a few years. But there are people who are truly feeling, you know, yeah, my kids are still with me. What are they going to do? Can they buy a house? Can they get a mortgage? What's going on? Am I going to be able to, you know, pay for my retirement? The fundamentals. But if we take out the subsidies that we give you know, to public education that helps create opportunity, then we create more of a polarization and we create more, oh my God, what am I going to do? I don't know what I would have done without a Pell Grant. I would not have, I know I could not have afforded the education that I've gotten. I don't know if that is even going to exist in the next 10 years or 2 years or one, you know. The student loan debt right now is abominable. What people are coming out of school with is unbelievable. And it's already creating a class of folks who have to work to pay their loans. How do we stop the polarization of wealth? And it's beyond just the Occupy movement, you know, which I do support. I support any movements, you know, that, you know, have principled. But how do we stop this polarization where the haves continue to have more and more and more? And even those who had a little can have less and less and less.
Well, you know, I would argue that the federal government is behind a lot of the student loan problem because, you know, they made access to money so easy that schools just said, we can make tuition more and more expensive. And so you rack up this debt and you find when you graduate that you can't get a great job with an English major or, you know, if you have how many PhDs in Shakespeare or whatever, you know, language poetry do you need out there? I mean, you can't get a worthwhile job out of that, but we've created a class of people who feel entitled to that and yet have this massive debt. So, I mean...
You think the massive debt for students is because they're saying Shakespeare?
No, I mean, I think there's been so much easy access to money that people have taken these loans and they've gone to school not thinking about what am I going to do with this after I graduated. And the government, I think, has, you know, schools have had no incentive to cut back. I mean, look at what a college campus is these days. It's, you have just this incredible sports center. The athletic complexes are incredible. The food is fantastic. The housing
those are different
is like
things.
Yeah.
No,
those are very different things. I mean,
well, it's basically funded by government money, though.
But not completely. I mean, a lot of it's funded.
Football. A lot of it's funded by those presidents going out there and doing a lot of begging to foundations. I know. I've been a part of it. But you know what? There have always been people who've gotten PhDs in English, and somehow they've gotten their jobs were available. Maybe not in their major. Maybe they've become, you know, the president. I just actually talked to someone who got a PhD in the arts, in acting, and she is now the president of Towson State University. You know, there's opportunity when you make opportunities, but the problem is there aren't as many opportunities, and that's not just the government's fault. You know, we have to look and see what's going on. What's happening with the polarization? What's happening with all this, the deregulation? You know, I mean, what's happening with gas prices itself? You know,
and I think that right now we can do this again. This has been a really stimulating discussion. It has been. It's been very good. And Martha Hummel-Mossberg is one of our guests, senior fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute and fellow at the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. Pardon me, columnist at the Baltimore Sun and the News Post in Frederick. As well as a host on BAL, taking over many times for the late Ron Smith.
Yeah, rest in peace.
We didn't agree on much, but he was a good man.
He was a nice man.
Sorry to see him go and what he had to suffer. And Leah Gilmore, Center for Emerging Media's cultural local correspondent, co-hosting the show many times, program director for Moving Maryland Forward Network. So it's good to have you both here, and I hope that you will join us again, Marta. It's good
to have
you.
Definitely. Thank you.
I know you
will.
Good
to meet you.
I will. It was wonderful to meet you, Marta. Definitely.
So stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back after this brief break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com.